Hi, everyone. Thanks, as always, for downloading and listening to our therapeutic rants. Just a quick note. We recorded 3 podcasts on opioid use disorder about a week or so ago, and they sounded fine when we were recording them, but there were some glitches via Skype when I went back and edited them, and so primarily on the second and third podcast. So I had to re-record a few segments and so on. I think they're pretty good now, but if you could please just have some leeway in your criticism or commentary about the sound quality. We did the best we could. I think you'll get a lot out of them, and hope you enjoy them. Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 418th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of Program and Practice Support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And continuing on from our last podcast, we have Dr. Tina Kronick on the podcast, and she's going to take us through the opioid use disorder that was published, guideline that was published in Canadian Family Physician.
And so if you've been following along, in our last podcast, we talked about how the systematic review was done, how it was put together, how the guideline was developed. And I think much of the time that we spent talking about that, you know, there are many places where this can be dealt with. And certainly the evidence is quite clear that this can be done definitely in primary care.
Mm. Yeah. So the next question is really, how do you pick it up in primary care? Is that where we're going here?
That is exactly where we're going. It's kind of the where's Waldo. You got to find the cases, team.
The where's Waldo. Yeah, this is such a huge issue. And actually, I was just at a mentorship day the other day with a bunch of mentors with lots of experience. And one of the mentors mentioned, you know, it's just so hard to diagnose these guys. And I thought that, again, validation that this is a tricky question.
Yeah.
So this is one of the big questions that came up with our committee. How do I actually diagnose opioid use disorder, particularly in my chronic pain patients? Because you have these patients with chronic pain. Is their pain just not controlled, or do they actually have an opioid use disorder? So we delved into the literature for this, and actually, Mike, this, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about this one, because I know you really enjoyed reading the literature around this.
Oh, yeah, no, this was fun. So it took a we'll give the DSM criteria in just a second, but let's just talk about what we found when we started to look, because originally we were going to do a how do you diagnose and then how do you screen kind of, or case find for this. Right. Probably case finding is a better term. Mm-hmm. But when we got the how do you diagnose, we quickly abandoned that because we realized that you cannot get, if you put 2 clinicians in a room on this, you will get 3 different answers about how to diagnose it. So that was a massive quagmire that just wasn't very useful. So we decided that in general, when you read the literature, that the DSM criteria are the kind of gold standard. Yeah. So, but I'll talk to you in a sec. We'll give you some more details in a second. But what kind of things are in the DSM criteria? So opioids being taken in larger amounts or for longer periods than intended. You've had a persistent desire or attempts to cut down but haven't been successful. You spend a lot of your time trying to obtain opioids. You crave them. And then it goes on. And then the 2 that are kind of the most challenging are tolerance, that you've demonstrated tolerance where you need to increase your medicine to achieve the desired effect, or you get a diminished effect from the same dose. That's tolerance. And tolerance, as you know, can happen once you've given opioids for chronic pain. So that one's really iffy. And there's lots of talk about, does that one apply in patients with chronic pain who are on opioids? And the last one, which is another waffly one, is withdrawal. And that's manifest by, obviously, withdrawal symptoms. And it's relieved by giving opioids again. And so normally you need 2 out of the 11 criteria from the DSM OUD diagnosis, and any of you really interested in reviewing all 11 of those can easily Google search DSM-5 opioid use disorder diagnosis. There's lots of graphics on the net about that. But if the 2 out of the 11 come from the withdrawal and tolerance, then it might not actually apply for patients who are who are in chronic pain and you're prescribing opioids for them, because they can easily develop tolerance over time. And then when they, if they tried to quit dramatically and were on higher doses, they would get withdrawal. So it becomes, and the truly the DSM criteria is quite waffly. Patients who are prescribed opioids for analgesia may exhibit withdrawal intolerance and would not necessarily be considered substance use disorder. Necessarily. So it's this kind of waffly nature to it that makes it hard for us on the front lines. Now, when you look at actually making the diagnosis or making the or finding patients, case finding, so not screening everyone in your practice, that would be just short of ridiculous, I guess. But going to look for patients who you suspect might have opioid use disorder, that we found 14 systematic reviews that looked at this, and they had anywhere between 6 and 50 studies. They examined 16 different tools that have been studied for finding or screening for opioid use disorder in a practice. Now, here's the real, I think, the craziest part of all of this. Their diagnostic gold standard, by which they compared those 16 different screening tools, there were 23 diagnostic gold standards used. So if you're wondering, boy, is it, it's hard to figure out this diagnosis. It's, you know, in primary care, it's hard. That's because we have 23 diagnostic gold standards by which.
And it almost, you sort of have to say, maybe the word gold standard should not be applied. You know, call me a cynic.
But you know how the diagnostic cohort studies are done. You compare whatever you're testing versus the gold standard. And when there's 23 different, as you've said, should be in heavy quotation marks, gold standard.
Maybe
it is a bit challenging to come up with. So what we did in ours, in our review of the evidence, is we said, let's make sure that the gold standard is one that is generally agreed on. So we chose the DSM criteria, and that meant, just by the evolution of the evidence, that it's either DSM-4 or 5. And then we really were left with two, something called the COM tool and another one called the PALM-I. And the COM tool, we won't spend much time on. It doesn't have a great positive or negative likelihood ratio. It requires 17 questions. They're 40 point scale, etc. So it's not even worth looking at. But the PALM-I was actually worth looking at. So the PALM-I is the Prescription Opioid Misuse Index, and it only requires 6 questions, which I'll go through really quickly in a second. But the positive likelihood ratio for that is 10, which is means it's going to be quite helpful in ruling in the diagnosis. And the negative likelihood ratio is 0.2, which means it's moderately helpful in ruling out the diagnosis. And even though it's supposed to be done by the clinicians, the questionnaire is quite simple, and we redesigned it so that it can be used by patients, so that they could fill it out themselves. So I'll quickly read you these questions, and I think you'll see. And if you need it, there's a copy on the Tools for Practice, and there's a copy in the guideline itself. But here are the questions. Do you ever use more of your medication, that is, take a higher dose than is prescribed? That's question one. Two is, do you ever use your medication more often, that is, shorten the time between doses than is prescribed? Number three, do you ever need early refills of your pain medications? Number four, do you ever feel high or get a buzz after using your medications? Number five is, do you ever take your pain medication because you're upset, using the medication to relieve or cope with problems other than pain? And the last question, question six, is, have you ever gone to multiple physicians, including emergency room doctors, seeking more of your pain medication?
And it's at this point during the podcast where I realize I need to seek an intervention.
So those 6 questions, and if you're positive for 2 of those questions, then you need to be then you should consider that person could or likely has a opioid use disorder, do more questions based on DSM as a result of that and make the diagnosis if necessary.
So once we've gone through that sort of process, it's we can then go on to the whole concept of treatment. But what's really nice about this sort of simple process is that, you know, these are very simple questions asked, yes or no, and very similar to what we've seen with the questions that we ask for depression and osteoporosis. And so it really, really makes life simpler when we have this sort of useful and easy approach.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I was going to say, once we make that diagnosis or we're pretty confident in it, Tina, you want to talk about whether we should taper these medicines or not? Like, I think there's some solid evidence there.
Yeah. So the next question, so you make the diagnosis, which we acknowledge is tricky, but provided some, you know, at least some tools to help clinicians work their way through that. One of the biggest questions, at least in Alberta, I know they did a quick survey of a group of physicians, and what they wanted to know the most about in this area was, you know, how do I taper my patients off of this? And I think this is a super interesting question because, like we said, with any other disorder, alcohol use disorder, we would stop the alcohol. But when you, so we try to look at the evidence around this. If you have an opioid use disorder, what is the evidence for me tapering you off of those? And initially we had questions like, should it be fast or slow? What's the evidence? And all of that. But what we found really is, first of all, if you look to taper to just continue prescribed opioids in someone who has been identified as having opioid use disorder, there's no randomized controlled trials looking at that. We found three trials where patients were switched to an opioid agonist therapy. So by that, I mean buprenorphine, naloxone, or methadone. So they were switched to an opioid agonist therapy and then tapered off. And all of those studies pretty much gave us the exact same outcome. Patients with pain, switch them and then taper them. But the trial was actually stopped after 12 because every single person who was randomized to the taper group quit or or transferred out. So it sort of gives you this hint that the tapering doesn't seem to be all that beneficial. Other trials were able to enroll just over 100 patients and again found that if you tapered patients, most of them dropped out. Only 11% stayed in the trial versus 66% on the opioid agonist therapy. And again, the third trial basically shows the same thing. And what some of these trials did is they tried to use lots of psychosocial interventions to support the patients. And regardless of that, they found that they just still were dropping out of the study. And
what I was going to say, it's not that some people couldn't taper, it's just not the best method to use.
Yeah, it's not the most effective method. And because there was such a limited amount of randomized controlled trial data on this, we did, and actually one of our colleagues pointed us to this observational data that we pulled up just to see if it was consistent with what we were seeing in the trials. And the observational data was a nice study that followed over 25,000 patients over 10 years who were on an opioid agonist therapy. And over that time, they found that only 2.5% successfully tapered off their methadone. So again, it is possible.
But the numbers are so small.
Yeah, the numbers are so, so, so small. And like one of my colleagues has very wisely pointed out, you know, if you have a rebound from alcohol use disorder and you go back and drink, it's unusual that you're going to die from that. But with opioid use disorder, if you have a relapse, there's a high risk that something bad is going to happen. So that idea that maybe tapering, and again, this is an opioid use disorder, not in chronic pain, so different, tapering seems to potentially be harmful. And this sort of led our committee to look at that recommendation that really the best evidence suggests that opioid agonist therapy is intended as a long-term therapy. And that sort of especially physician-initiated tapering doesn't seem to be the best way forward.
Yeah, so, and Tina, that's key, right? Because you'll have patients come in who want to try and taper off the opioid that they're using or what have you. And certainly if they're keen to try that and you don't feel that they're at high risk of relapse or as high risk of relapse, then offering them the opportunity to slowly taper them is not unreasonable. It's just what we're saying here is that for the average patient, strong advocacy for a taper is probably not well-founded. The evidence is that most patients will really struggle to have a taper. And as you said, the kind of anecdotal result of that can be that they, because they've now been off for a while, their tolerance has now gone down. And then when they return, or if they return to substance use, they can, it can be very, very dangerous for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, again, from my specialist colleagues in this, that reframing it, almost thinking of it in the context of diabetes, would you ever, if you thought of diabetes as a, you know, problem with excess sugar intake, would you ever at some point say, okay, now we're going to taper you off your insulin? I mean, it's a bit different, I recognize, but that idea that look at it more as a chronic disease that we're managing.
Yeah.
There's also some data on fast versus slow taper.
Yeah. So that was initially when we first had the questions, we thought, well, let's look at, you know, what's the best way to taper, when we thought tapering was something we should be doing. Trials. And fast was sort of defined as, you know, between 7 and 28 days, and slow was maybe up to 56 days. So most people will say that's actually rapid versus ultra rapid in the world of addictions. But what these RCTs did show was that the slower tapers had improved patient satisfaction and fewer withdrawal symptoms, which makes sense. And again, which is consistent with that observational data that suggested that, in the observational data, they considered slow tapering, say, over 52 weeks, again, was significantly more successful than a really rapid, say, less than 12-week taper. So, again, not recommended as first-line therapy, but if you had a highly motivated patient who really wanted to do that, the slow taper, the evidence is best for that.
So that's the evidence around tapering. And then I guess the obvious next question is then, what treatment do you use?
Yeah, so we looked at the two main opioid agonist therapies we looked at were buprenorphine, naloxone, and methadone. And again, for both of these, the most common outcomes we found were retention and treatment and abstinence. And I think it's worthwhile addressing that idea of is retention and treatment a valid surrogate marker? And there's lots and lots of observational data that suggests if you are retained in treatment, you have less mortality and overall improved outcomes. So there's likely some validity to it. You could argue there's confounders in that observational data, of course, because you may be retained in treatment because you're just doing better, or your life is less chaotic, or what have you. But those are the outcomes that we have. So looking at buprenorphine, naloxone versus placebo or no interventions, there's 9 randomized controlled trials with 2,500 patients that show that initiating buprenorphine results in improved retention and treatment. So about 65% of patients are retained in treatment compared to 40% with a number needed to treat of 4. Methadone is similar, has similar numbers, 6 RCTs looking at that. Retention treatment, 73% versus 22%, number needed to treat of 2. So we would say they're somewhat similar. They both show fairly good retention in treatments. Those numbers needed to treat are reasonable in our medical world. And similarly for abstinence, again, buprenorphine versus placebo has a significant improvement in opioid abstinence, 60% versus 39% with a number needed to treat of 5. And again, methadone is similar. So a couple of things from those numbers I think physicians will appreciate and find empowering is, again, even with abstinence, not everyone is abstinent. This isn't a all or nothing. It's a harm reduction intervention. So recognizing we're trying to improve outcomes, but we're not going to see 100% abstinence. We're not going to see everyone retained in treatment, but there is evidence that it does help some patients.
Yeah, and in the placebo or sort of no treatment comparative trials, methadone does look slightly better. With the absolute differences with buprenorphine is around 25%, and with methadone it's around 50%. But there have been some sort of head-to-head trials that can sort of help us with that question.
So the head-to-head comparison of methadone versus buprenorphine, treatment retention, methadone does seem to be a little bit better in the trial. So 60% versus 45%, number needed to treat of 7. Some of those populations were slightly different populations again. So there may be some benefit with treatment retention, but if you look at abstinence, so opioid abstinence, objectively measured, they're similar in outcome. So methadone versus buprenorphine, and the head-to-heads, you see about a 30% in both groups.
And I think it's also useful to think about sort of like what we've talked about in previous podcasts. If you look at the success rate in the drug group, or like, for instance, in the buprenorphine group, you know, you're seeing about a 65% treatment retention. And in the sort of the placebo or no treatment arm, it's about 40%. So you will see a lot of people benefiting, you know, from this, or having sort of treatment retention. But you have to remember there's that 40% sort of no treatment or placebo group response. So having a difference overall of 15%, which is actually quite similar to what we saw, if you guys remember, in the sort of depression trials with the placebo versus versus the antidepressants.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point.
All right, what is next, Tina? Naltrexone?
Yeah, we could talk briefly about naltrexone. We included it in our review because there's some new data coming out of the States, particularly around injectable naltrexone, which is a longer acting formulation. And so some question, is this another reasonable treatment for patients with opioid use disorder? When we compared, so when we looked at the data, we looked at oral plus injectables and compared to placebo or usual care, it does improve treatment retention. The numbers aren't quite as impressive as the opioid agonist therapies. And these trials, about 33% retention versus 25%. The number needs to treat of 13. That's based on 8 randomized controlled trials. Again, not amazing numbers, but there's some level of benefit. And most of these trials were done in patients being released from prison. Because the thing about naltrexone, which we weren't aware of when we started this, but you need a 7 to 10 day opioid-free period. So that really makes it tricky in a primary care community setting. You know, if you have someone actively using opioids, to get them to be opioid free for 7 to 10 days is going to be tricky. The population where this might work is people, say, being released from prison, or who, you know, have concerns of a relapse or something like that, I suppose. So it's the only one that has done trials looking at reincarceration. So the claim to fame for naltrexone is it decreases reincarceration with a number needed to treat of about 12. So 24% versus 33% based on 4 randomized controlled trials. There is a head-to-head compared to buprenorphine. Compared to buprenorphine, it is worse for treatment retention. And that number needed to harm was 4, actually. So it looks like the opioid agonist therapies are better for treatment retention and opioid use. So this might be a select population where it might be considered. I know some rural docs and other groups have said this might be an option, but I can't imagine it'd be the most commonly used one for sure. And the injectable is not currently available in Canada, although I have heard some docs tell me you can import it, but...
So one of the things that happened in the process of us doing this evidence review and building kind of a case, Tina, was that people were coming to us and saying, oh, you missed this study or missed that study. And we had a challenge because a lot of them were, it turned out when we would find them, they weren't randomized controlled trials or systematic reviews that we had missed, but rather cohort studies or case controlled studies. And one of the case control studies was kind of a correlation study, where what they did is they looked over time and they looked at deaths from or heroin overdose, and they compared that to when buprenorphine was added or started to be given. And in this graph, which we obviously can't show on the podcast, there's, you know, a dramatic reduction in death rate or heroin overdose rate just as buprenorphine is taking off. And many people find this kind of graph very compelling, and they'll say things to us like, well, this shows that it works. And we always point to, there's all sorts of correlation statistics that are absolutely ridiculous that are as impressive and compelling. And we pulled this one from spuriouscorrelations.com, I think it's called, and it just shows that honeybee producing colonies are dropping off at the same rate that juvenile arrests for marijuana are increasing. And the correlation there is very strong. So if you're someone who believes in correlations, you might look at this and go, oh, well, that's the reason why honeybees are dying off, is because kids are getting arrested for marijuana. And so we always tell people what you need to do is if you have a belief system, you have to prove it's either right or wrong. And that doesn't mean selective use of information that agrees with you. It means going to look at the literature. And so what we did is Tina and her team in particular, I wasn't involved in this one, so Tina, interrupt me at any time, but we took a bunch of randomized controlled trials that did provide some amount of information on deaths. And those were from buprenorphine, methadone, and naltrexone. And if they were compared to placebo or no intervention, we put all of the trials that had mortality related data with those interventions that were the OAT kind of interventions. And when we piled them all up, there were 10 trials and there were 13 deaths in the control group and 4 deaths in the pharmacotherapy group out of about 470 in each arm. So this is not something you normally want to do because the math is a bit tricky. Some of the control groups in particular had zero outcomes, which means for those of you who know about meta-analysis, you can't have zero in as a numerator. So you have to add something in. So you either add 0.1 or 0.5 of a person to give a to, and so you're falsely promoting it in the way of the you're giving zero more weight than it really has, but it's the only way for the math to work. It's a known thing that you do, and when you do that, because you're getting a rough estimate, you usually use, and the event rates are rare, that means you can use odds ratios, and that's exactly what we did in this case. And we had the help of our friendly neighborhood statistician who always works with our group, Ben Vandermeer. And we got an odds ratio of 0.29 with a confidence interval of 0.08 to 0.88. So obviously very broad, but this at least is stronger evidence that these opioid agonist therapy or OATs are actually reducing mortality as well. Now, again, we might have suggested that from the cohort data, and we might have felt that way clinician observation and expert opinion, but this is probably, I think this, Tina, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is the first time this evidence has really, this has ever been shown in meta-analysis from randomized controlled trials.
Yeah, for sure. So we think that's kind of cool. We also think we have to be careful because it's kind of exploratory, like you said. But what I love about it is, again, a lot of us struggled a bit with those surrogate markers of treatment retention, because you could argue, oh, you give a patient a drug and they stay in treatment. Well, what does that mean? So trying to look at other outcomes like mortality, again, is this actually improving mortality? And this is certainly not an absolute, but kind of like the primary care management of opioid use disorder, it's definitely trending in the right way. And it's showing that there very well could be an improvement in overall mortality. And if anything else, you're likely not harming the patient. So that's really reassuring.
And as Mike said, it is, you know, the best available evidence. At least it's suggestive that it isn't increasing death. So that's always a good thing. And, you know, trials don't always look at mortality.
Right. And so I think this was the right path to go. We were getting a lot of pressure from people in the community who do substance use disorder or are in public health and wanted us to use case controlled studies and cohorts that, and sometimes selective data that supports that belief system that buprenorphine is preferred and has these great benefits. But we would prefer to try and find that information with, or confirm that information as best you can confirm anything with true randomized control trial data. And we were lucky that there was just enough data to do that. But it was interesting to me, and it shouldn't surprise me, but it was interesting the amount of enthusiasm for us to use observational data because because some people wanted the result to be a certain way.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're so skeptical of that, right? Because we've been burned so many times in the past looking at observational data to inform us. So, and again, I think this is helpful for clinicians who are a bit wary of this intervention or this treatment. You know, why am I giving people who have an addiction problem more, opioids. But the evidence is, somewhat convincing that it does improve outcomes and may actually reduce overall mortality.
Yeah, and I think this is part of our reframing, Tina, just what you were talking about in the last podcast about how we kind of, we have certain biases and beliefs and it's different for different types of addictions and all of that, which we weren't necessarily applying to different types of addictions. And then we came up with this idea that, oh, probably abstinence is the best and we need to withdraw patients before we looked at any of the data.
Yeah.
And the more you look at this data, the more you realize this is a chronic disease and it needs to be approached like a chronic disease with a harm reduction strategy rather than these kind of any kind of black or white belief systems that some people have about how we approach this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so this has been great, some great stuff. So I think we'll end the podcast now. And in the next podcast, we'll talk about things like urine drug screens, contracts, how to deal with the comorbidities, you know, and a few other questions that are associated with this, and just wrap everything up in just a very nice, tidy little present.
Absolutely. With a pretty little ribbon on it.
Perfect. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
All right. Thank you.
Talk to you later.